October number 13. We're continuing in our discussion of Bezdin procedural rules. And we have seven questions that are posed. First one is, can civil court grant jurisdiction to a Bezdin if the parties do not otherwise submit to that Bezdin? We know that Bezdin is allowed to utilize the authority of the civil courts in order to enforce its judgments and even to enforce its jurisdiction. But what if, from a halakhic perspective, the Bezdin didn't start out having jurisdiction, but a civil court decides that it's going to convene a Bezdin? They decide this is a case that's appropriate for Bezdin, and we think this is a good Bezdin to handle the case. So we're going to decide that we will assign the case to a particular Bezdin, or let's say it's a Zabla type of case, where each side is supposed to pick a Dayan. So if you had that type of arrangement for a regular secular arbitration, such as under the auspices of the American Arbitration Association, and let's say the two judges or arbitrators were chosen by the two respective parties, and the two arbitrators can't agree upon a third arbitrator, so there's a mechanism whereby the court system will step in and decide who the third arbitrator will be so that the case can go forward. What happens if a civil court steps in and decides that if the two Jewish law judges who have been selected by the parties pursuant to a Zabla proceeding can't agree upon a third Dayan, would a court be able to step in, and what would be our perspective if a court would step in? So that's all included in question number one. Question number two, does Reuven have to provide a detailed claim for Shimon to review? Person brings a case in Bezdin and asks for Bezdin to send a summons, how detailed does the summons have to be? Typically, if somebody is summoned to civil court, there's a very extensive complaint which is filed, and a person who is a defendant in an action can read through in great detail exactly what charges and claims are being brought against them so that they will know how to defend themselves before they show up on the court date. To what degree does a party who summoned a defendant in a Bezdin action have the same right for a detailed claim to be issued prior to having to show up in front of the Bezdin to argue the case? Third question, how do Reuven and Shimon evidence their commitment to submit to a specific Bezdin? That once we said that nowadays, for the most part, we quoted the tshuva of Moshe Feinstein, that we don't really have a Bezdin kavur. He was talking about New York City. There is no one set Bezdin that everybody has agreed upon to accept as their official Bezdin, the way that, for example, in many European towns and cities, it was understood when a person was brought in to be the Rav HaYir, he was brought in to be the Av Bezdin, to be the chief officiating judge presiding over all disputes that would occur within the city limits. And it was understood that it was deemed as if every single resident of the city had accepted this person as their chief presiding judge. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says nowadays we don't have that mechanism, we don't have that infrastructure or framework anymore, and therefore no Bezdin has jurisdiction over parties, by and large, unless the parties specifically agree to select that Bezdin. So what's the mechanism by which their selection is considered to be enforceable? Do they have to pick up a handkerchief, do a Kinyan Suda, do they have to sign a Shtar Beiruvin, an arbitration agreement, do they have to do both? Is there always a need to sign an arbitration agreement? Then, must the Bezdin issue a written decision? Can the Bezdin just turn to the parties and verbally give a decision? Or can the Bezdin just write a written decision so it will be enforceable according to arbitration law? Because under arbitration law, in order to employ the shoterim, the civil court system, to enforce the Bezdin determinations, it's necessary for the Bezdin to issue a written decision because that's what's required under arbitration law. But the written decision can simply say, Reuven and Shimon had a dispute. Reuven and Shimon, you know, went up a hill and, you know, one of them, you know, fell and broke their crown. And we've decided that you know, or say Jack and Jill went up the hill, and we've decided that Jill owes Jack $5,000, but without any kind of explanation as to why Jill owes Jack $5,000, or does the Bezdin have to elaborate upon the reasoning behind their decision? Finally, six, that's the next one. Those Bezdin spell out the reasons for a decision. And then finally, is there a right to appeal? Under Jewish law and the way in which Batei Din are currently configured, is there a right to appeal? And if there is a right to appeal, how exactly does that play out? After all, we don't have a hierarchy of Batei Din, where there are lower Batei Din, and there are appellate Batei Din, and then there's some supreme Bezdin, Hagadol, Sanhedrin. We don't have that anymore. So if we don't have that type of a system, so how exactly would appellate review take place? In Eretz Yisrael, where the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate, has set up a series of rabbinical courts, and by the way, that existed even before the Hakamas of Medina, even before 1948, when the official Medina was established, the fact that there is an authority to the rabbinate and a recognition of rabbinical courts was not anything that was officially established in 1948, contrary to public perception. It was something that existed even when the State of Israel was called the State of Palestine and when it was under British rule. It existed during that period of time, and the decision for the rabbinical courts to maintain and sustain their authority was called the status quo decision at the time, that they weren't going to mess with the existing authority, but it really existed even prior to the Hakamas of Medina, and already in the days of Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, of Rav Cook's Hatzal, there was a decision made based in large part upon Rav Cook's endorsement and support to have not only rabbinical courts set up in different cities, but also to have a hierarchy where the higher court, the Beis Din HaGadol that would sit in Yerushalayim, would be able to review upon appellate application decisions that were handed down by the lower court. So what is our perspective towards this, and to what degree do we have this type of a system in effect, or can such a system be in effect outside of Eretz Yisrael, where it's not under official governmental auspices? Let's start with the first question. We have here a tshuva by the Mincha Shlomo. This is on page 2 of the materials. This tshuva Mincha Shlomo, the title tells you more than the tshuva does. This was in the posthumously published volume, so the Mincha Shlomo, meaning it's not volume 1, it's in volumes 2 to 3. And volumes 2 to 3 were published after his death, and sometimes they're a little bit sketchy because they're like the continuation of a conversation, as if you'll be picking up after maybe Rav Shlomo Zalman spoke to somebody on the phone and then they asked for a follow-up letter, and he's sort of assuming the first two-thirds of the discussion because the recipient has already heard of all that already, so he's only writing down the last third, and you have to sort of put together the pieces of the puzzle on your own. So you find that a number of places in the later volumes of the Mincha Shlomo. So here, the title tells you more facts than you could glean from the text of the tshuva. It says, "Kfiya lavo lebez din ayudei arkos." What if a person is compelled to go to a certain bezdin based on the order of the courts? Now this came up even in my own experience, because in the early years of working at the Beis Din of America, there was an Aguna case. There was the case of a man who was refusing to give his wife a get, and they were litigating many different aspects of the divorce and trying to do it through a Beis Din process. They couldn't agree upon a particular Beis Din, so it started out as some type of a Zappel proceeding where the wife chose one dayan, the husband chose another dayan, the two of them chose the third dayan. There was a zabla proceeding in effect, but it fell apart. It unraveled. It's not entirely clear why it unraveled. It all depends, I suppose, who you speak to. Maybe it had to do with the dynamic between the dayanim, that there wasn't really a meeting of minds, and eventually one of the dayanim just decided that he would recuse himself from the case, and they were left without a full Beis Din, and there was nobody else to replace the one who went away, and the whole thing just unraveled, and it ended up in court. In the meantime, the husband was saying that he wanted to go to specific Batei Din that he felt more comfortable with, but the wife didn't feel comfortable with the rabbinical courts that the husband wanted to go to, so it was in court. And the judge said, "I have this major issue that I'm not able to resolve." It was a judge in New Jersey, said there's this issue regarding the get, which is really beyond my jurisdiction. It's an ecclesiastical matter. It really should be dealt with by a Beis Din. And I think that there is an appropriate Beis Din to hear this case, but based on everything that I read and hear, and that is the Beis Din of America. So he directed both parties, he required both parties. This is, you know, not something the courts generally do, but this judge felt that it was appropriate under the circumstances, required both parties to show up in front of the Beis Din of America.
Is this a Jewish judge?
This was, I don't think it was a Jewish judge.
But he knew a lot.
Part of, I think, what might have been his consideration, I can't say for sure, is that at the same time that this judge was making this order, there was also a decree that was issued by all of the shul rabbis in the town where this couple lived directing that both the husband and the wife should appear before the Betin of America. Now it happens this was the Betin that the wife was most comfortable with, but the Shul rabbis felt that this was the Betin that was best equipped to handle the case with professionalism and integrity and sound judgment with respect to both parties, and therefore they directed the husband that he should go there too. Was that a factor in the determination of the judge? I'm not sure, I don't know. But that happened at the same time. Then in addition to those two factors, the parties did show up. The husband showed up more or less under protest, that he felt that he should not be required to submit to a betin that he had not selected himself. But nonetheless, on the appointed day, the parties did show up. The husband showed up with a rabbinic advocate, in fact, so that he actually had representation. He also showed up with a woman who would transcribe all of the proceedings, a court stenographer who would write down a transcript of everything that would be said. And the case that was presented, really mostly through his rabbinic advocate, who did most of the talking, according to my recollection, was that he felt that the Betin didn't really have jurisdiction, and that was really the main gist of the presentation that he made. But he did show up in front of the Betin to argue the case, and the wife showed up as well. So afterwards, the husband said, look, I'm not going to submit. The Betin asked the parties to sign a shtar beruin, to sign an arbitration agreement in order to confirm our jurisdiction. We said we're not comfortable issuing binding decisions in this case unless we have a signed arbitration agreement. If the husband has various tainus, if he has various claims against the wife, then we would be happy to hear them, but we want it to be through a very, you know, clear, voluntary submission to the Betin. And then the husband said, no, I'm not going to do that. And afterwards, all that we did, again, based on my recollections, we issued a letter that essentially just summarized what took place in front of us. Not anything, you know, scandalous or nefarious, just a summary. The parties appeared before us, and there was no agreement to sign arbitration agreement. We'd be very happy to put together and oversee some type of a renewed Zabla process where there would be an agreement on different dayanim that the parties would choose, and those two could choose a third. And that's the way that we left it. The husband, in the meantime, felt that he was being pressured to appear before this Betin, that the Betin was issuing some type of a letter that the court, you know, might then interpret as a statement that the husband wasn't carrying out the court's wishes of submitting to the Betin. I suppose maybe that was a concern. Hard to say. All I know is that the three dayanim who sat on the case, including myself, all received summonses. We received the hasmanas. We were summoned by a different Betin. Summoned by a different Betin that this party had turned to, and the party's rabbinic advocate had turned to as well. And this different Betin summoned us all for damage that we had caused to this individual, presumably by convening a Betin altogether. So at the time, I responded. First, there was some discussion, and they asked if we could send a lengthy written tshuva response as to why we felt that we did the right thing. It was sort of a peculiar thing in general for one Betin to summon another Betin, because we have a general principle of Bezdin Basar Bezdin Lo Daiki. One Betin does not examine the activities of another Bezdin. Again, if you had a hierarchy and you had a system where maybe there were lower courts and upper courts, then maybe it would be a different story, but that's not what we were talking about. We're talking about one Betin in one borough and one Betin in a different borough of New York City. And the second Bezdin, which was in Brooklyn, summoned us. And I wrote a long tshuva at the time, explaining why it made sense for the Betin to at least to have sat down with the parties and to have had this preliminary meeting. So I made three points. One was the party showed up. Whenever parties show up, so that already creates a certain achrayus responsibility on the part of the Bezdin to listen to the various claims and submissions from the parties. There's a tshuva sarash, which is quoted by the Beis Yosef and Simon B'yud Beis of Chol Shemishpat, where the Rush says that even if parties haven't signed an arbitration agreement, but all they did in life, all they did was to show up in front of the Bezdin and to make various claims and presentations in front of the Bezdin, that already creates a certain jurisdiction, and it also, at the very least, triggers the principle of Bezdin Basa Bezdin Lo Daiki, that another Bezdin does not have the right to step in and question the first Bezdin once the parties have actually made submissions in front of the first Bezdin. Yes?
But did you discuss only the authority of the Bezdin?
That's all that we were dealing with.
there was nothing about the case itself discussed.
Very little. We really didn't get into the substance because we were really talking about process and procedure, which we felt was the appropriate posture of the case at that point in time, which was another argument, obviously. Second argument was that there are various tshuvos that state explicitly that in the event that you have communal authorities, you have communal rabbanim that all get together. This is from the Maharika says this. This is in Simen Aleph and Simen Kofpei of the Maharik. It's based on a sugya in Baba Basa, Dachos Chesavid Base, that if you have all of the community leaders that used to be represented by the Zion Tzuvei Yair, by the seven distinguished gentlemen of the city, but if we don't have Zion Tzuvei Yair, so the Rabbanim, who are appointed as the leaders of all of the different communities, could stand in and serve in that capacity. All the Rabbanim together directed that the parties, it wasn't just the rabbi of one shul, but all the Rabbanim of all the major shuls in the community, directed that they felt that both the husband and the wife should report to the Beis Din of America. So that also, according to many authorities, quoted the Ma'ariv, quoted the Gemara, would bestow the Beis Din with authority to be able to deal with this case. And then finally, I cited from this tshuva of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach talks about what if you have a husband and a wife who are in a situation where they're fighting over a get, and the courts themselves don't have the authority to deal with the situation, really should go to Beis Din, but there's no agreement regarding which Beis Din they should go to. So he refers, he writes, this is a letter to one of the Dayanim in the Beis Din of London, and he says... Page two. It's the first source. Aleph on page two. Okay, and he says that you don't. There's no fear of a get meusa that any get that would come about through the case being directed to a Beis Din by the courts. There's no fear of get meusa. Ki ha'arkos rakofe oso leofia bifnei Beis Din, because the courts are only compelling the husband to appear before a Beis Din Shiyisrael in front of a Jewish court. And obviously the Beis Din is not going to coerce the get, but they will speak gently and nicely, as we always do, right, to the husband. And he could bring any claim he wants to bring once he's in the Beis Din. Even if he's going to be very strong, you see, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was experienced, obviously. And even if he's going to be very obstinate at first, Yonah will have to be smart about it. The Ishtadul Ashpia level, Igram Vargadol Azul Ishtav Gamla Asma, not to do this terrible travesty to himself or to his wife. And if they can make their words be heard, then this would obviously be a very big mitzvah, and certainly the Chas V'Shalom Shum Isoy would not be a coerced get, no problem there. But if he's going to remain stubborn and remain in his rebelliousness, as I base the thing, then the Beis Din, wink, wink, nod, nod, knows what to do and what not to do, whatever that happens to be. Says the Bat Din, understand the parameters of their authority and jurisdiction. Yes?
I'll come in your case with New Jersey principle of Dina Malchus Adina didn't play
there. In what sense would it be Dina de Malchus Adina? There's no get law in New Jersey.
No, but if a court orders you to appear and you violate the order,
that's up to the court system. The question for us is, what was the extent of our authority? Do we say Dina Malchus Adina applies even to the ability of a court to designate a Beis Din to hear the case?
I'm going to go with the answer to the Brooklyn Bay thing. Look, the...
Well, this is part of the answer. I mean, the truth of the matter is, what you're saying is with Shlomo Zalman, meaning the very fact that the court, we always say that the court does play a role as shotrim. The very fact that the court, the shotrim, this is sort of in the opposite direction. Normally, the shotrim are involved first, in the sense that we issue a decision, and then we turn to the shotrim, the court, to enforce the decision. Here, the shotrim, we're in the very first instance turning to the shotrim, saying, we want to designate you to hear this case. So the question is this considered to be an appropriate... an appropriate fulfillment of the role of the Beis Din or not. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach indicates that he thinks that this is perfectly appropriate in this type of situation where you have an aguna situation, for example, and you would not have a resolution otherwise. In fact, look at his second paragraph. Very, very fascinating and stirring paragraph. He says, Ulam, a reform imamish. You have to worry that the Beis Din is going, that the husband is going to choose a Beis Din that is inappropriate. It's not made up of appropriately experienced and wise and proper dayanim, or a reform, or mamish reform. I mean, exactly. Therefore, he says that he thinks that it's very, very important that it should be be that the court determination should give the choice only to the woman herself to choose which bezdin that she feels that she wants to go to. Even though we have this general principle that we discussed last time of Hokin Akara Nitba, the Nesivos, he says, doesn't matter. In this particular case, what we are looking for first and foremost, the overriding principle that really supersedes all of the other principles, is that we want to bring about a just result. So justice in this case is only going to be served if the woman, the wife, is going to be able to choose the best. And even if the husband is the Nitba, let the woman lift go the best and shehi rotza that she wants, vazenachas v'ikarak v'isha. This is most important thing with respect to the woman, that she receive her gift. This is a matter that pertains mostly to her, that she not be an aguna. And don't worry, for sure, she's going to pick a bezdin like the bezdin of America, obviously, or the CRC bezdin. She's going to pick a bezdin kosher to adjudicate the case. So, the third argument that I made was that, in fact, the court deciding to delegate the case to the bezdin was not necessarily an intrinsic flaw from a halachic perspective with the process, because this is something which was very specifically countenanced and endorsed by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who's considered to be, you know, one of the Gedolei Hador, certainly of this past generation, and he wrote this in his own tshuva. So I think that really took them, you know, by surprise. But this is in fact what he says, that sometimes the courts, when there somebody needs to step into the breach, and you're going to have chaos otherwise, and you don't have, you know, this type of autonomy. Remember, what was it that gave the Batei Din the autonomy in all the European countries and cities anyway? It was the government. The government bestowed them with that type of autonomy. So if you think about it, what Shlomo Zalman was saying was not terribly radical. He was saying, you do, as long as it is a proper bezdin, sometimes it's appropriate for the court system to take advantage of the court system stepping in and saying that justice is not going to be achieved otherwise. We're going to step in and we're going to designate a particular bezdin. So therefore I said it was not outrageous for the bezdin to assume jurisdiction on that basis. But the final argument was exactly what you said, which is that even with all of those compelling reasons, they showed up and they argued the case. The communal leaders designated the case to the bezdin. The court system designated the case to the bezdin. We still said to the parties that we're not going to listen to any substantive claims or issue any kind of substantive decision unless they both agree to sign on the dotted line. Otherwise, we'll just try to preside over the procedural process to steer them in a direction which would conform with the procedural requirements of even putting together a Zabla bezdin if they couldn't both agree to voluntarily submit it to the bezdin. So therefore, the closing argument was, we're not exactly sure what we would have done wrong, even assuming that you would exercise this notion of one bezdin examining and scrutinizing another bezdin, which we don't really do, because we have this principle of bezdin basa bezdin lo daiki, which is discussed by the Rosh and others. But even, and the Beis Yosef, for example, reaffirms that principle in his Tshuvas in the Avkas Rochel. But even if you would allow for the possibility of one bezdin scrutinizing another bezdin and go against the well-established practice and custom for centuries and centuries of all of the Batei Din, there's no basis here for any kind of a claim. So that was the last that we heard of it. I understand that the letter that we sent was then passed around to various rabbinic authorities. I heard it's made its way to Israel somehow, because I got word that this was reviewed by various rabbinic authorities in Israel. So I remember Rabbi Willig saying to me at the time, oh yeah, I heard that they asked. They said, who is this Yonah Reese who wrote this thing? So I said, you know, but he said, no, but they said it in a really good way. You know, you should feel flattered. So I said, okay, thank you. I appreciate that. But that was the last that we heard of that particular case. I mean, the truth of the matter is, it's a very fascinating case from a procedural perspective, but a very tragic case from a substantive and real life perspective, because the mice of the husband did not end up coming to the bezdin. The parties weren't able to agree upon any particular bezdin, and it's fine. As far as I know, the case was never resolved in terms of the giving. In terms of the giving of a get, as far as I know, and that's a really, really tragic thing. Which is why, when you think about it, that you have to, you know, cut. And I guess that's what Shlomo Zalman was saying as well. You have to, you know, cut beyond all of the red tape sometimes in terms of just, you know, the strict picayune procedural rules and look at what is necessary lahatzel oshek mi'ad oshko, just to bring about a just result in a particular situation. But, you know, this goes very much to that point of whether and to what the role might be of the court system in terms of helping to facilitate the convening of a proper Beis Din in order to resolve these types of matters.
So he had a problem with the Beit Din, but he had no problem going to the court system?
Well, who entered the court system?
He was in the court system first.
No. The court system, first it was a Zabla that fell apart.
Right.
Then it ended up in the court system. Again, he would have been happy to go to any number of other Bati Din.
He was forced
but she didn't want to go to the Bati Din that he selected. This was the Beis Din she was comfortable with, but he wasn't comfortable with this Beis Din. We weren't able to find the Beis Din or Shava that they were both comfortable with. I don't think so.
And last time you said...
No. The London Beis Din case was not the case that we were dealing with. That's a totally different case.
And last time we had Shear, you had a combination of you and the California where you formed a combination Beis Din to get the both plaintiffs.
Absolutely, and we would have been very happy to do that in this case. It's sort of unfortunate that it didn't work out. And I'm not casting aspersions in any of the parties, but I'm just saying this is, you know, the way that it played out, and it's unfortunate. Now, in another twist of this, if you look at the second source, there was a case in New York in 1974 which really does place limitations. I mean, again, if this judge's authority had been challenged, I don't know how that would have played out. If somebody would have brought an action saying, what right does this judge have to designate a particular Beis Din? So I don't know if they would have found that the judge really did have that authority, because at least in this New York case, the opinion from 1974, although there was a dissenting opinion, but this was the majority opinion that, as far as I know, is still binding precedent in New York. There was, again, a divorce case between a husband and wife, also revolving around the get, and there was some type of an agreement that the parties made that the husband would pick one rabbi, the wife would pick a second rabbi, right? They would have this rabbinical tribunal that would be selected through a zabla, and two rabbis would pick a third rabbi. What happened was that the plaintiff had chosen a rabbi, and that the plaintiff in this case was the husband, and the wife had chosen a rabbi, and the two rabbis could not agree on anybody who they would both be comfortable with sitting as the third rabbi. And eventually, the husband's rabbi just left. He just bolted. He abandoned the case. So all that the wife had was her designee, was the borei, the rabbi whom she had selected as a dayan. So a court, one of the lower courts, stepped in and said, we're not going to just like if it was the American Arbitration Association, we would step in and we would pick a qualified individual so the arbitration could take place. We're going to step in here as well. We'll find somebody who we think, based on our research, is a rabbi in good standing, is a qualified rabbi in the community of these individuals, and we will designate that person to be the rabbi on behalf of the husbands, so that this person can then work together with the wife's designee to select the third rabbi, and then we'll be able to convene the Beis Din panel. So that was the order. You see here it talks about this like a 1ABC. It says, 1, the order on defendant's cross motion appointed a certain rabbi as plaintiff's designee. That was the lower court's order. Okay? So if you look at the very end of this page, very end says the order was reversed. The husband brought on appeal that he felt that it was not proper for the court to step in and to decide who should be sitting on a Zabla panel, that is ecclesiastical interference, and the court agreed. Said order reversed without cause, turn to the next page. And the reason why the appellate court came to the decision that the lower court, which is called special term, had no right to do this, because, and this is the general principle enunciated by the court, special term had no authority to, in effect, convene a rabbinical tribunal. That the feeling was that based on the separation between religion and state, even though if it would be a non-religious arbitration, it would be some sort of secular arbitration, then the courts would be empowered to step in and to select a missing arbitrator in order to round out a panel. If it's a religious arbitration, even though courts will enforce religious arbitrations, will even compel religious arbitrations if the parties have agreed to a religious arbitration, they're not going to step in and actually name the judges and select who the rabbis should be who should hear the case. So we see that there are some limitations, even from a secular perspective. It's kind of interesting. From a halakhic perspective, would we be comfortable with that? We probably wouldn't be. We would not be comfortable with a regime where there was a possibility, if parties would sign an arbitration agreement, and they couldn't agree on a dayanim, that the court would step in and say, oh, you have to choose Rabbi so-and-so to sit as a judge on this case. We would also view that as an interference of sorts. On the other hand, as we see, sometimes, as Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach pointed out, it could be very useful when a court, you know, steps in and serves in this capacity. I think that probably the distinction from our perspective would be, is the court working together with the rabbinical authorities, or is the court not working together with the rabbinical authorities? How do you define who are the authoritative rabbinical authorities who we would want to work together with the court on these types of cases? You could argue in the first case that if all the rabbinical authorities of the community in which the couple lived, on which the parties lived, felt that there was a particular bezdin where the case should go, even if there hadn't been binding jurisdiction, that since from a halakhic perspective that's meaningful, so therefore we would be more comfortable with the court's interference in that case. And in the situation of pal versus pal, so I think that we would probably be less comfortable, and that is more consistent with the court's decision in this particular case. So that's kind of interesting. But if they're not actually selecting the rabbis, but they're just directing the parties to a religious arbitration, courts have no problem with that. If you look at source number 3 over here, just to give you, you know, a little bit of extra context, this is called Meshel versus Oyv Shalom Talmud Torah, District of Columbia Court of Appeals case in 2005. What happened was that the parties did not select a particular best, and they just said that if there is any dispute between the leadership of a certain Orthodox Jewish congregation and this membership, that it cannot be amicably resolved, then it shall be referred. This is what the bylaws said. The corporate bylaws said that it would have to then be referred to a betin of Orthodox Jewish rabbis for a binding decision according to Jewish law. So there were members of the congregation who said, okay, so we want to invoke this to go to a betin. And then the congregation itself refused to participate in the betin according to the court decision. And they argued that enforcing this provision would cause the court to be entangled in ecclesiastical matters, which would be a violation of the establishment clause of separation between religion and state. And the lower court ruled in favor of the congregation that it had no obligation to submit to betin. Now, this is interesting. I can understand on some level that it would be a more binding type of provision if the provision said that would agree to submit in front of a particular betin, because then you have a specific arbitration tribunal named, and there isn't as much of an involvement on the part of the court in determining exactly how this court is going to be convened. You don't have the pal versus pal issue of convening a rabbinical tribunal. What was unique about this case is that there was no specific rabbinical tribunal that was named. It just said a betin of Orthodox Jewish rabbis. That's what the bylaw says. So the lower court said, this is too nebulous, and therefore we're going to grant the motion to dismiss. That's what the lower court said. But, fortunately, for the betin system here in America, the Court of Appeals stepped in and reversed the decision of the lower court and said, we reverse. Look at the second to last paragraph. We conclude that well-established neutral principles of contract law can be used to determine whether the betin provision in the bylaws is an enforceable arbitration agreement, and if so, whether the party's dispute falls within its scope. We therefore hold that the civil courts have jurisdiction consistent with the First Amendment to resolve the action to compel arbitration. We conclude the betin provision does constitute an enforceable agreement between the congregation and its members to arbitrate their underlying dispute before a betin of Orthodox Jewish rabbis, and we accordingly direct the trial court to compel the congregation to comply with its agreement. So this was really breaking new ground, because, as I said, there have been precedents beforehand, such as the Vitzor versus Vitzor case in New York State, which said that when the parties selected a particular betin, then that could be considered a binding arbitration agreement that would be enforced by the courts. But here the court said, even though you have not named the betin, you'll have to go through this process, presumably an ecclesiastical process on some level, of going through the betin system and navigating that system in order to convene the rabbinical court of Orthodox rabbis according to Jewish law. Nonetheless, since the bylaws require this to be done, this would not be an entanglement with religion or with ecclesiastical ecclesiastical matters, but just a regular enforcement of an arbitration agreement, and the parties therefore were obligated to take whatever steps would be necessary in order to convene the rabbinical court. It presents a little bit of a conundrum, which, you know, the court didn't go into, which is that on the one hand, if you accept this decision, the Ohev Shalom decision, then the parties can't resolve the matter in court. Neither party can require the other one to go to court. It has to be done through the convening of a betin. On the other hand, if they can't agree on three arbitrators, they can't ask the court to come in and intervene to select who the arbitrators would be if you follow the ruling and holding in Powell versus Powell. So you might end up getting stuck at some point along the road, but the court doesn't address, you know, how to deal with getting stuck, and fortunately it wasn't, you know, necessary apparently in this particular case, because this is the end of the line of published decisions when it comes to this case. So this is what, you know, the Beis Din has to navigate on a regular basis, which is to determine what are the mechanisms that we're comfortable putting in place that would involve some type of court intervention in terms of seeing to it that we have a proper Beis Din jurisdiction, a proper Beis Din mechanism and framework that we're able to put into place. And sometimes when you're really, really stuck, what we see from Shlomo Zalman is that it is not necessarily inappropriate, at least from a halakhic perspective. I can't speak to the constitutional issues, but at least from a halakhic perspective, it's not inappropriate, even if there wouldn't otherwise be jurisdiction according to civil law, for the rabbinical leaders to implore the courts to step in at the beginning of the process and to ask the courts to intervene to designate a particular Beis Din, again, in accordance with the wishes of the rabbinical authorities, in order to bring about a resolution to a particular case. Okay?
No, as a practical matter, people drafting contracts and these kind of agreements, isn't that where you're better naming a specific Beis Din?
You're so much better naming a particular Beis Din so that you don't have to go through all of these hoops and go through all of these headaches, which is why we very strongly encourage parties at the very outside of any kind of transaction that they include a choice of forum provision in their contracts that say that if we have any dispute, then we agree not only to go to Beis Din, but to a very specific Beis Din. I mean, we don't do that in our CRC contracts, because if we enter into contracts with other kashrus agencies or with vendors or with various mashkichim and the like, where we enter into contracts, either the service contracts or employment contracts and the like, so we have, generally speaking, at the CRC a Beis Din provision, but we can't put in the Beis Din provision that there's a dispute that arises between the CRC and another entity, that the matter will be resolved by the CRC Beis Din. It doesn't look very good, and it's kind of like an automatic built-in conflict of interest. So actually, in our CRC contracts, we have a Zabla mechanism, which is built in. This way there's a sense of, you know, an absolute impartiality and fairness that this it's better this way. If one of the parties is a Beis Din, then it's generally better to, for the sake of objectivity and fairness, to allow for a Zabla process. But if neither of the parties, that's a, sort of an unusual circumstance, obviously, but if neither of the parties are actually a Beis Din, so then it's better to choose a particular Beis Din so you don't have to go through all of these vagaries. I mean, we had this issue also, I remember when I was at the Beis Din of America, let's say it was an RCA rabbi who wanted to bring a claim against another individual. Technically speaking, the Beis Din was is affiliated with the Rabbinical Council of America, so we would send the Hazmana, we send the summons to the other party, we would say, just for your information, the plaintiff is a member of the RCA and our Beis Din is affiliated with the RCA. If you, we feel that we can be impartial, we can panel an impartial an impartial group of dayanim to preside over the case and to adjudicate the case, but if you feel uncomfortable, you're certainly welcome to choose a different Beis Din. And sometimes they would say, no, we're perfectly comfortable, but a lot of the time they would say, no, we're not perfectly comfortable. But, you know, that was a necessary point of disclosure and very important to point that out explicitly. The truth is that the published rules and procedures say explicitly that parties can choose a different Beis Din, but when you have that specter of a potential conflict of interest, even if you don't feel it's a conflict of interest, but it looks that way, then you have to spell it out very, very explicitly for the sake of professional integrity. We'd have the same thing with any type of case, let's say it would involve the OU in theory. Okay, I'm not saying it was ever such a case. But if there would be such a case, so that would also require saying that we're sponsored, we receive a certain amount of money from the OU, and if they're going to be a party in this case, you should know about it. We feel that we can impanel impartial dayanim to hear the case, but you can choose a different bezdin. But for an organization to impanel its own bezdin to hear the case, so, you know, that's a little bit tricky. I spoke about that in the context of our Sugos Gvul cases, where you can't really hear a case if you have a particular stake in the outcome of the case. Like, for example, deciding whether or not you're going to give hashkaka to a particular entity where another restaurant is claiming that this new restaurant is going to infringe upon their livelihood, but the kashrus agency would make more money to allow the second store to open up. So there are certain types of determinations that really have to be beyond the purview of the bezdin. But you have to think about these things. It's not automatic that people just, you know, think about these things all the time. But you really have to. But assuming that you don't have those types of conflicts in place, so then of course it's always appropriate for the parties, if they're comfortable. And remember, the parties are more likely to have a meeting of minds at the outset of a transaction regarding which bezdin they're comfortable with, whether it's a husband and wife signing a prenuptial agreement, or whether it's two business partners signing a business partnership agreement. They're going more likely to be able to see eye to eye regarding which bezdin they're going to select to hear any disputes at the beginning of a transaction, rather than when the relationship falls apart and each one is going to look out for their own agendas, and they may not necessarily feel that the bezdin that one party is comfortable with is the bezdin that they should be comfortable with. So therefore, that's always a very, very good idea. So that's really the next topic of discussion, which is, what is it that the Shtar Beruin, that having this arbitration agreement, what is it going to accomplish? So we have the Gemara in Bava Metzia, the Mishnah in Bava Metzia, that talks about if you find the Shtar Beruin, you return it to the parties. And the Gemara says, what's a Shtar Beruin? So there are two different descriptions in the Gemara what a Shtar Beruin is. One say it's a Shtar of a transcript of the proceedings, that Reuven said this and Shimon said that. And the other opinion, Rabbi Yirmiyah, says, Zebo lo echad is Zebo lo echad. What does Zebo lo echad mean? It means exactly what we're talking about. When we don't have an established bezdin in a particular jurisdiction, and the parties have to name specific arbitrators who are going to hear the case. So that's really why you need an arbitration agreement. So you look at source Hay over here, in Siman Yud Bey Sif Zion, so it gives you another reason why a Shtar Beruin is a useful thing to have. Because one type of authority that we give Bati Din, that we give rabbinical courts nowadays, is to decide the disputes in accordance not only with strict din, not only in accordance with the strict letter of the law, but also in accordance with pshara, right? But which means to settle in accordance with compromise or equitable principles, principles of fairness and equity, which are not necessarily strictly in accordance with the letter of the law. Now, parties, according to strict halacha, are not required to agree that the bezdin will have the authority to make compromises and to decide according to principles of equity. So they could say to the bezdin, Yikov Adin Sahar, let the law pierce the mountain, which is a way of saying that we don't want any kind of compromises, no pshara. I remember when I used to play baseball in camp, so, you know, it was like a learning camp, you know, Marishakola. So I remember that there was one boy when we played baseball in high school, so he was a very starker fellow. We ended up in Lakewood, actually. He's still there now. Whenever there was like a question about bending a rule, looking the other way, somebody missed the base, whatever it was, you know, maybe we'll go easy, we'll give a guy a fourth strike. So he would always say, no pshara. You know, remember, that was his line, his tagline, no pshara. So sometimes a person comes to Bezdin, he says, no pshara, I'm not allowing any compromise. I don't want settlements. I want exactly the letter of the law. So we try to discourage that. The Gemara already says that we very strongly encourage mitzvah l'tzoa. We very strongly encourage pshara. That's what we want. But we can't compel that upon the parties. So says the Shulchan Aruch that one way in which you can make sure that the bezdin will have jurisdiction with respect to pshara is if they make a kinyan. They make a specific transaction a binding commitment. They do some type of a transactional act which creates a binding commitment from which they are not allowed to withdraw afterwards. That's what we call a kinyan. Usually that's done through a kinyan suder. Kinyan suder means, like, I give a handkerchief or I give a pen, right? You see that a chasen tissue all the time, right? The chasen lifts up a pen and thereby commits himself to everything that's written in the ketubah. And I even walk around with a handkerchief, because that's a suda, literally means handkerchief. Most people nowadays, they wouldn't know a handkerchief if it's, you know, slapped them in the face. Because, you know, it's not, yeah, but you know, in the younger generation, we don't have, you know, handkerchiefs, you know, nearly as much. When I worked as a lawyer, what I always say is, when I worked as a lawyer, at Cleary Gottlieb Steen in Hamilton, so I had a secretary, she was a Pentecostal Christian, a very nice lady, though. I'm a very nice lady. And she, one time for my birthday, she bought me a handkerchief, but it was like very cute. It was handkerchiefs. So every single handkerchief has like a picture of an Indian chief on it. So I still have these this day, because I never actually used it as a handkerchief. I wouldn't know how exactly, you know. So I use these handkerchiefs. Whenever we have a Besdin proceeding that requires a Kabbalah's Kinyan, I bring in one of these handkerchiefs, and maybe I'll bring it in next time, and the person lifts it up and makes a Kinyan. So that's sort of our official Besdin handkerchief, Klei HaDayanim, our official Besdin, you know, handkerchief, that's what we use. So you could use a handkerchief, but says the Ramah, the Kinyan Lav Davka, it doesn't only have to be a handkerchief. Elahu adinim nasa shtar iluya echad mishar alav, shtar alav, o echad mishar dachi akniya. It could also be a shtar. You can also have a contract which the parties sign, in which they agree that they're going to be bound by pshara. So this is one of the essential reasons why it's useful to have the shtar biruin. Number one, because we don't have a Besdin Kabua, we need the shtar to memorialize that the parties have agreed upon a particular Besdin or a particular Zavla panel. And number two, that the parties are accepting upon themselves the authority that a Besdin can decide the case, even according to Pshara, even according to principles of compromise and equity. In fact, we have an entire book of rules and procedures that set forth all the protocols and procedures that we want the parties to bind themselves to. So just as they bind themselves to the pshara, so they also bind themselves to all of the rules and procedures and protocols of the Besdin, which, as we shall see as we go along, is of great importance as well. Yes?
Reuven and Shimon signed a partnership agreement. One of the provisions in the partnership agreement is a binding arbitration clause that says, in case of any disputes that cannot be resolved in the hand of the parties, the parties shall agree to be bound by the decision of the Beit Din Center, the Chicago Rabbinical Council, blah, blah, which may employ expectations, whatever. And they signed that partnership agreement. Mm-hmm. And then, let's say, Shimon refuses to sign an independent sharp reroute. Could Reuven argue that by his signing the partnership agreement, which contained the partnership clause, he in essence signed a sharp reroute within the context of the partnership agreement?
I don't need a separate sharp reroute in that case. The beauty is that if the parties have signed in their original partnership agreement, original prenuptial agreement, that if there's a dispute, they agree to be bound by the decision of the best, then we don't need a separate standalone arbitration agreement afterwards. I have decided cases, we have issued rulings in cases based on a clause in the contract that simply said that the parties agree to be bound by the best. And I think if you have a combination of the clause in the contract plus the fact that the parties actually showed up in front of the Besdin and submitted their claims in front of the Besdin, then I think that a court, generally speaking, would enforce any decision that was issued by the Besdin, because they would say even the parties respected the binding nature of this arbitration clause because they showed up in front of the Besdin. Let's say that you only have the arbitration clause and one party, and it's now 4 years later, they have a dispute, and one party refuses to show up in front of the Besdin. From a Besdin perspective, if I had the party sign a Shtar Beruin 2 months ago, for example, and now one of the parties refuses to show up on the day of the proceeding that has been scheduled by the Besdin, so I have no problem issuing a decision in favor of the party that does show up against the party that doesn't show up, as long as sufficient evidence obviously is produced by the party that does show up, because I have a pretty fresh arbitration agreement that shows that the other party agreed to be bound by the Besdin. Remember, we issued a $1 million verdict in such a case. case that was upheld by the New York City, by the New York court system, and it was reported in the New York Law Journal, that particular case, I remember, which was, you know, good prestige for the Besdin. But if the agreement had been signed, let's say, 4 years earlier, then I might not be as quick to convene a proceeding. I might say, I might direct the party who wants to enforce the arbitration clause to first go to court and have the court compel arbitration based on that clause, just to be on the safe side, because I don't have the same paper trail of recent vintage that shows that the other side was granting us jurisdiction. But if I had the combination of the clause in the contract plus the parties actually showing up and presenting their pleadings in front of the Bez, then I would consider that to be sufficient for issuing a decision without requiring a new signed arbitration agreement. I had a case like that where after we issued the decision, apparently one side refused to comply, and then the side that had been victorious, had won something in the arbitration in the Din Torah case, wanted a copy of the arbitration agreement, because his lawyer said he needed a copy of the arbitration agreement in order to enforce in court. And we said, we don't have a standalone arbitration agreement. We have a clause in your original contract. And he seemed a little bit disappointed. He said, oh, but my lawyer said I'm supposed to have an arbitration agreement. He said, no. You didn't need an arbitration agreement. You had the clause in your original contract. Go ahead, take this to court with the arbitration decision. This should be enough. We never heard, again, about that case. So I'm assuming that it was good enough, but I don't actually know what happened in that particular case. I assume that if we don't receive complaints, it means that everything went smoothly, but that's not always necessarily the case, but I hope it did.
Will you grant a get where there is not a formal divorce ahead of time?
I'm sorry?
Will you grant a get where there is no formal divorce ahead of time?
Well, that's a different question. Would we grant a get when there's no formal divorce? Well, if Henkin held, Yosef Eliyahu Henkin wrote an article in the Torah journal Hapardes a number of years ago, I think in the 1960s, or maybe even the 1950s, he wrote the article. He said that there's a major problem that people are waiting until the end of their civil divorce before they do the get, because often what happens is that the acrimony intensifies as the case goes along, and then even if there was a willingness to do a get at the beginning, there won't be a get at the end, or the parties might simply forget about doing a get if they're not particularly religious once the dust has settled and the civil divorce has already been issued. So he said people are under the misperception that it's against the civil law to grant a get, a Jewish divorce, prior to receiving a civil divorce. So he wanted to make it very clear. He's spoken to lawyers. He's done his research. It's not against the law. And he said one thing. He said with one proviso. He said it's a good idea that the get should be done as early as possible in the process, once the parties know that they're going to get divorced. But the Besdin should write in the Teudas Gerushin, they should write in the certificate of divorce, of that neither party is allowed to get married according to civil law until they have received their civil divorce. So it shouldn't look like the Beit Din is trying to contravene the civil law. But as long as the Beit Din inserts that clause, he said it's not a problem. So what's kind of interesting is that most of the Batei Din with which I am familiar routinely write that line in their Teudas Gerushin, in the certificate of Jewish law. Nobody even knows why we write that line. We have nothing to do with the civil divorce per se. But the reason I think that this became routine for all of the Peturin, all of the official Jewish divorce certificates of all the rabbinical courts in North America to include this line is based on Rav Henkin. From a halakhic perspective, the only concern would be that will the husband claim afterwards, I never would have given the get had I known that she was going to claim A, B, C, and D. In which case, he would claim that it's a get mutto, that the get was given under mistaken pretenses. So for that reason, part of the official get script is that the wife is asked at the time that she's given the get, do you waive any claims that you have with respect to the ketubah, with respect to the Jewish marriage contracts, that there won't be any surprises, so we know why by the time the get is given, she's generally waiving her rights to the ketubah, or if she isn't, then we say to the husband, please understand that even if a claim is brought afterwards and you're not happy with the result, that has no bearing on the validity of the get. And the Aruch HaShulchan suggested, and this is something that various Misadri Gittin, various get officiants have suggested, maybe all of the rabbinical courts should do nowadays, the Aruch HaShulchan suggested that it's this question that we ask of the wife, whether she waives her rights to the ketubah at the time she receives the get, should be expanded. understand it. And the question should be, do you have any monetary claims whatsoever? And both parties should be asked, and it should be made clear to both parties, regardless of whether you have any monetary claims that you're planning to assert after the get, please understand that the validity of this get is not dependent at all upon your satisfaction with the manner of the resolution of those claims. So that's how we address any potential halakhic issues. The other halakhic issue that's pointed out by the Menashe Klein is Mishnah Halakos. He wrote a letter to Rabbi Kenny Alman. Rabbi Kenneth Alman is a rabbi of the Young Israel of Flatbush in Brooklyn. So he wrote a letter to this Rabbi Menashe Klein from Brooklyn saying wouldn't it be a good idea in order to avoid a lot of the Aguna situations if all the Rabbanim could come out and encourage that a get be given as early as possible in the divorce process. But Menashe Klein said there's a separate problem, which is the Gemara in Suvas and Daf Kof Tes, where the Gemara there talks about how once there's a divorce, there's a krisus, there's a cutting off of husband and wife, they're not supposed to appear together anywhere again. And if they both show up to a Beis Din again after the get, so then we either put them in Chayrim or we whip them, depending, you know, on the circumstances or on, you know, the inclination of the judges. But the clear implication of that Talmudic passage is that they're not supposed to be in the same room, even to adjudicate, you know, monetary issues. And if the various monetary disputes have not yet been resolved, and they're still going to have to appear either in a courtroom or in a lawyer's office or in a Beis Din afterwards, so that's going to be in violation of the Gemara in Ksuvos. So that's what Menashe Klein said. That's why you have to wait until everything is resolved. However, later authorities, including, or more recent authorities, including Mordechai Eliyahu in a psak din that he wrote for the Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim in 1996, and also Rav Yosef Yibad L'Chaim Tovim, Rav Yosef Goldberg, who's a dayan right now in the Beis Din, either Beis Din Yerushalayim or the Beis Din HaGadol Yerushalayim. He's the author of an authoritative new sefer on the laws of Gittin called Tivo Shel Get. It's a very popular sefer because it's the sefer that every dayan really wants to have. Like, there are lots of sefarim written on Gittin that you don't have, like, you want to read, but you don't have time to read. But Tivo Shel Get, everybody reads, because the whole sefer is about what happens when you make this mistake or that mistake or the other mistake or the other mistake, you know. So that's the sefer you really need in your office. So Rav Yosef Goldberg is the author of that sefer. He also wrote the same thing as Mordechai Eliyahu, that this halacha, that the husband and wife are not supposed to interact anymore after the get, what that means is that they're not supposed to enter into new transactions, into new monetary dealings or partnerships with each other. But if they're getting together to adjudicate old disputes that arose before the get, that's perfectly acceptable. They read that into the Lashon of the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Vav, seems to imply that, and they read that into the Shulchan Aruch, and that seems to be the general consensus nowadays. So therefore, we will do the get prior to the civil divorce. It happens that, I guess we'll end on this, it's just an interesting question. It happens that I raised this question, I was in Memphis last week doing Beis Din business in Memphis, and I met with Ramnutza Greenblatt. Ramnutza Greenblatt, you had a question, right? Okay. We met with Ramnutza Greenblatt. I met with him. He's like the dean of the Misadre Gittin, of the rabbis who officiate a Gittin in America. I think he's been doing it for something like 65 years, something like that. And he travels all across North America to hit towns and out to the boondocks and the like in order to ensure that Gittin be given by people regardless of location, that nobody should be deprived from the ability of doing it again. He's an unbelievable person. Certainly Memphis is one of them, but he'll go out from Memphis to lots of other places too. So, and places that have much less Jewish settlement than than Memphis.
Can you undo a get?
When a get is done, it's supposed to be binding. We issue a cherem. At the conclusion of a get, we say, you're not allowed to cast aspersions on a get after it's given. But you want to put in all of the protections so that it shouldn't even be a remote possibility for somebody to say, oh, the get was given under mistaken pretenses. So I asked him, I said, do you have a preference in this regard as to the timing of the get, whether it be before the civil divorce or after the civil divorce, given the various concerns that there'll be a claim claim that maybe the husband didn't know what claims would be brought against him, or that it's not really perfectly appropriate that the husband and wife be together in the same room according to certain authorities. So he said that with respect to people who are outside of the Orthodox community, he thinks for sure the get should be given as early as possible for the reasons that Rapenkin mentioned, because otherwise they just might forget about it altogether. And he said he's not worried that somebody from that community is going to say, well, had I known claims would be, they wouldn't enter into their imagination that one thing has any connection with the other one. It shouldn't have a connection according to us either, but it might at least enter into the imagination. He said as you get more into the Orthodox community, then you have to figure out, is there a real concern that if you don't do the get now, this is going to be a Naguna case, so then you should do the get as early as possible. If you're not worried about a Naguna situation, so then he said that he could certainly see the argument in favor of, you know, waiting until everything is finished and concluded and doing the get at that point in time, if that's not something you have to worry about. However, Rav Melech Schechter, Zatzal, that's the father of Herschel Schechter of YU, he was a very distinguished dayan in New York, based on his experience, and he did thousands and thousands of gittin, based on his experience, that he started out with that same perspective. I think I had this conversation with him once as well. He started out with that same perspective, better to wait until the very end when everything is all wrapped up and completed, but then as he saw all of the aguna situations that arose, when a get wasn't done as quickly as possible, he completely changed his position, and he came around to the point of view that in every single case, you have to worry about the possibility of aguna. You can never say about any case that it's not going to ultimately result in some type of an aguna situation, that you should always do the get as soon and as quickly as possible. So we'll end with that, you know, side discussion, and we'll continue with the other sources in Yetzir Shem next time.